netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. For this podcast, just like the last one, we're also offering a video stream of the podcast for those of you who signed up for the FX Guide new content email notification. We basically get an email every time we launch a new article at FX Guide. If you're interested for signing up for that, all you need to do is go to the right-hand side column on any article on the site and sign up. Our guest for this episode is Bilawal Sidhu. He's host of the new TED.ai show podcast, as well as wearing multiple other hats, which you'll hear about at the start of the interview. Mike and I met Bilawal at the FMX conference in April and really enjoyed his talk on AI and machine learning. He also took part in a roundtable that Mike moderated as well. And we both thought he'd be a great guest on the FX podcast, so we're happy to have him on. Among other things, the guys talk about the state of current tools in the AI and machine learning space, including generative AI, Gaussian splats and NeRFs, spatial and visual intelligence, as well as key players such as Wonder Dynamics, Move AI, ChatGPT, as well as what the future might hold for traditional rendering engines versus neural rendering. So let's go ahead and cross that interview now.
Bilawal, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Haven't seen you since Germany. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I will say a long-time listener, first-time dialer.
Very kind of you. Hey, I wanted to pick up a discussion that I said we started in at the FMX conference in Germany, because that was so interesting. And I think people would be really interested to hear that discussion. I guess it's going to be around, obviously, Gen AI and stuff that's going on with AI. But I thought there's a lot of interest in this topic. There's also a lot of people very concerned about it. There's, you know, like lots of competing stuff going on in media and entertainment at the moment. I mean, in particular, people are very worried about, you know, what's going to happen. I think it'd be good just to kind of do a survey of where we think things are at and also be able to just highlight specific tools that we've kind of both come across that we think are kind of interesting rather than... Because as I think I said to you when we spoke, I really hate people that are futurists that talk in like, you know, terms about what's going to happen in 10 or 20 years time, because they just don't have a clue. So
where's the thing so I can start use with, right now, damn it, right?
Exactly, yeah. And also that whole like 10 years from now, like you just know that they're just making it all up. Hey, so if someone was to ask you what Gen AI is, what would your answer be? What's generative AI?
So generative AI to me is nothing new. It's an evolution of machine learning, and it is basically marking the transition from machines that can understand to machines that can create. Historically, the delineation has sort of been discriminative AI versus generative AI. So, you know, ML-based systems that can discriminate, let's say you show them a depth estimation model, an image, and ask it to predict what the depth of every pixel is going to be. A very narrow model, right? But still predictive in a sense, predictive of the depth in the scene. And then we saw lightweight predictive capabilities, let's say autocomplete when you're typing inside of Docs or Gmail, where here's just like the next word or two based on what you've written thus far. But with generative AI and sort of the large and large language models, these models have gotten so big and so powerful, they can write entire reams of text for you, now generate images, videos. To me, it's really about machines that can understand to machines that can now create.
Yeah, so we've got all those models that are really good, for example, for segmentation and classification and identification, right? And in that sense, they're doing really useful things for media and entertainment and helping us with a whole lot of things, but they're not really sort of generating stuff in the way that I think, because I think from my point of view, like we were aware of machine learning, most people, and some of us were using machine learning. And then there were sort of two waves that happened. There was the wave of people suddenly saying, what's this ChatGPT thing? Quickly followed by a wave of, have you seen this Sora thing? Right. okay. So my question, I guess, at the outset from your personal point of view is this not just another wave like we saw with, I don't know, there was blockchain, then there was NFTs and like that. Is this just not the new bright, shiny thing? Like, how is this any different? Or is this not going to just settle down into being a fad or not?
I think it's both, right? And we got to get very used to it being both things simultaneous, especially in this day and age where there's so much hype around generative AI and like, oh my God, this is like the end of Hollywood. And even knowledge workers, like I talked to a lot of knowledge workers, like they're just working like 9-to-5 jobs in corporate America. and they have this perception of what, you know, ChatGPT and systems like it can do. And then they go use the tool and realize that it isn't this like crazy kaiju monster that's like about to stomp them, and more like a kind of a chaotic golden retriever that you can sometimes coax into doing useful things for you. So I think it's both, where there's like an inordinate amount of hype around generative AI, but I think it's fundamentally different. And I think it goes back to what we were discussing, where at the heart of all these machine learning systems was a prediction engine, but the ability for us to predict, you know, like just longer form content is getting, whether that's like a whole, like, you know, 16 pages of text or an entire, like, you know, 1 to 10 minute video now, is totally plausible. And so I think that's going to be transformative and is definitely going to change how we create things. But at the same time, yeah, like the hype surrounding it is just insane. And I think we need to clamp it down, because it actually prevents like productive discourse, and worse, alienates certain people from even engaging with the technology.
Okay, so in a second, we're going to discuss spatial intelligence and stuff to do with visual intelligence and Gen AI in like a bunch of detail. But let's just back up now and sort of establish where you got to be at this position. Like, what's the kind of backstory of where you're at right now for people that don't know you?
So I'm an AI and 3D creator, and I make entertaining and educational content on the internet for over 1 million subscribers across YouTube, TikTok, Twitter. I'm also an angel investor and a venture scout for Andreessen Horowitz, and I'm the host of the TED AI show.
I don't rush through that, because those are all really interesting things, right?
Yeah.
So you're at the coalface with terms of investing. You've also got this great new podcast, which the TED AI show, which, by the way, we totally recommend, because you've only just started, but some of the guests you've already had have been incredible. Especially was it Helen from OpenAI? Like, was listening to, yeah,
just indeed
amazing. So that's a whole lot of stuff. So you're in the thick of it, yeah. But you got to the thick of this how? Like, how did you get to be an angel? How did you get to be such a kind of central figure on this journey?
Totally. I'd like to
say, you before that.
I'd like to say I replaced one big job with three little jobs now. And so prior to being a content creator, I spent a decade in tech, predominantly at Google, where I was a senior product manager, working on efforts across immersive capture, AR, VR platforms, and geospatial 3D mapping. And if I take a step back even before that, really my love for all of this stuff and how I discovered like your website, your writing, FX PhD, all of that is like, you know, I fell in love with computer graphics at the age of 11. VFX and CGI became like this magical thing to me, because I saw this TV show called Mega Movie Magic and Splat on Discovery Kids. So this is like back in the cable TV days, kids. I was really into Flash, like 2D animation at the time. Obviously Shockwave and Flash was the thing du jour back then. And it blew my mind like that the same computer I was using to make like cheesy vector animations could be used to create stuff that was almost indistinguishable from reality. And so then I self-taught myself Maya, After Effects. For the longest time, I wanted to be a visual effects compositor actually at ILM. That was like the goal. And then VFX supervisor at ILM. But as I got older, I got more into the technical and business side of things and ended up studying computer science and business administration at the University of Southern California, and then did my decade in tech.
How was it at Google? That was kind of Google's golden period, right? Like that was the period where Google could do no wrong.
I would say I'm still very bullish on Google, despite the very awful headlines they've been getting, especially with the recent generative AI search rollout, which is hilarious to say the least. Honestly, it was a blast. It was particularly fun because I joined right as spatial computing or AR VR was picking up. So this is like right after Google Glass had come out. 360 video was super hot because the DK2 was a thing. Everyone was thinking about immersive forms of capture. How do we imbue, you know, more of a sense of like space and surrounding into these systems? And to be able to go work on those platforms, work on YouTube VR, create the camera systems to capture the world in immersive 3D and drive like billions of hours of watch time was like an absolute blast. I mean, like we worked with all the big brands, the little brands, the small creators, everything in between, from like Coachella to Teen Choice Awards to Elton John to some of my favorite YouTube creators. That was a lot of fun because, you know, it's like, I think for for me, like AR and VR really is just the visual effects pipeline running in real time on the phone in your pocket or the headset on your face. A lot of the technologies and techniques are so similar. So I felt this like very seamless transition for the things that I'd been very passionate about since a little kid to the stuff that was front and center in the tech industry. And then as AR, VR, like, you know, kind of like, or VR rather transitioned more towards mobile AR, it became even more fun because like I worked on AR Core and infusing these phones with the ability to basically like run 3D tracking in real time, detect geometry, freaking, you know, estimate lighting, play stuff, basically do, again, VFX compositing in real time was a lot of fun. And I got to work with some of the smartest people in the industry that have literally written like the seminal books and papers on these things. So that was a lot of fun. And I would say even more fun than that, and I alluded to this in our conversation at FMX, is geospatial 3D mapping. Because like, to me, that's just basically like, yo, like, let's go map the world in 3D again and use aerial and ground level and like satellite sensors, space sensors to create this ground up digital twin that I then had the opportunity to launch as the AR Core Geospatial API or VPS, the Visual Positioning Service. And then, of course, Google Maps Immersive View. So you can do like a remote vibe check of where you want to go, basically creating a simulation of that exact place. So Google was awesome because like that's one of the few companies in the world where you could even go take on such a challenge to map the world.
Yeah, I remember back in the day when first I was told that Google was going to drive every road in the world to have, you know, like a road view. And I was like, I just couldn't fathom that you would be in a place that you could actually do that. But, you know, like that's the wonder of tech, right? Like every once in a while, somebody comes up with an audacious idea and you go, I mean, that is so incredibly useful. I actually think the stuff you're talking about with the later spatial stuff, that's almost like infrastructure right now that I don't even feel like we've fully taken advantage of. I don't know
100%.
If you would agree. Yeah, it's like there's so much to be done in that space. And there's a lot of infrastructure now for very minute positioning and spatial location stuff that I'm seeing, especially with digital twins, but it just hasn't kind of yet been mainstream, but I think that's coming.
100%. I think like you'll see the same sort of, you know, boom and bust cycle play out with generative AI too. I'm almost feeling it right now itself where it's like, where people had such inflated expectations about even what the metaverse was going to be, right? Like, oh my God. And everyone's been waiting for the breakout moment for AR, VR to hit the scene. And it never quite happens. And it ends up being both an install base and device problem, especially on the spatial computing side. It's like, how engaging is AR? Like, I would guess that the most compelling uses of AR in the entertainment side are like front-facing camera selfie filters on like Snapchat and Instagram, right? And then on the world-facing side, it's things like AR walking navigation and Google Maps or some of the stuff micro-mobility companies are doing to make sure like you parked your scooter in the right location. We don't quite have that like, you know, form factor that would warrant reskinning the world and layering 3D channels around it. Though certainly companies like Niantic are trying, but I would argue even they haven't quite caught that lightning in a bottle again that they did with Pokemon.
So just going to just the general area of spatial intelligence and stuff, there's, for me, the most interesting stuff that's been happening in this space personally has just been what's happened with 3D Gaussian splats and obviously NIRFs in the last, you know, I guess 2 years. That's been amazing. And I feel like even there, as amazing as that is, where we don't yet have enough control of those post-capture to yet take full advantage of doing them. In other words, we've gotten tech that's insanely great at doing these 3D spatial reconstructions, but they're a bit like lacking in humanity almost because we don't have sort of animated people. We can't like animate them as much as we want. What companies do you think are doing really good work in that 3D Gaussian splat, say, NIRF kind of space?
There's a couple of companies. I think a lot of the most interesting work currently is happening still in research and academia because of the things that you alluded to, right? So like the fact that we've got a pretty decent static representation of the world is cool. But when do we get to 4D or dynamic 3D Gaussians, right? Like, so we can finally shed the crappy videogrammetry pipelines of yesteryear that just look like crappy GTA, old school GTA, to something that's like closer to, you know, the digital double that, you know, you were embodied as, and be able to do that in, like, you know, do that dynamic capture with real talent on a set. I think we're getting there on the research side. On the productized and like the commercial side, there are a couple companies that I would point out, certainly Luma Labs. I think Luma AI was the first company when everyone else, especially in the photogrammetry world, by the way, I'll preface this just by saying that I think to your point, we're like, we haven't quite figured this stuff out. Like, people are like, well, photogrammetry is dead. I was like, you know, structure for motion and photogrammetry is just going to live on for another decade. It's tried and tested. Oh, yeah. It's in production pipelines. It's been used in AAA games. It's used in Hollywood productions. So I don't think that's going anywhere. But as a,
and just LiDAR, right?
Oh my God. I mean, LiDAR as a way, like, especially images, like basically, you know, active and passive sensing of the world, I think are both really exciting modalities to capture stuff and definitely not going anywhere. Some of the stuff around using LiDAR for 3D Gaussians is very, very interesting as well.
I've got to say, when I saw Luma AI not only do a great nerf, but then take that nerf, admittedly aesthetic, but take that nerf into Unreal Engine and then what they could do, it's just like amazing. But it was also, it's so amazing because we can move in the space. And now I want the space to move and me to move in the space.
Totally. I mean, like, you know, the world is not static. There's so much, like, you know, we, like, you know, you've got seasonality, you've got like the leaves subtly moving. The world is just so dynamic and brimming with life and motion. And we got to be able to encapsulate that. I think we'll see progress on that within the next year. But certainly Luma AI is one company I'd call out. I think they really brought neural radiance fields to, like, the broader, like, to a broader community by making it accessible on your freaking smartphone.
I would
honestly give NVIDIA some credit for that before with Instant NGP as well, because in a circa 2022, when the NeRF paper came out by with Google researchers, basically, like, you needed a boatload of TPUs to go, like, process one radiance field. And then Instant NGP dropped, you know, 2022 as well. Or sorry, 2021 was the original NeRF paper. And then 2022, when Instant NGP dropped, it's like, holy crap, I can train this like on one GPU, like in 8 minutes.
It just accelerated it just by 100-fold, didn't it? It just was like,
oh my God.
It was such an enabling point where there's a couple of points in this whole kind of journey where you go, I can remember when we first got the classification stuff happening, where suddenly, you know, there was like this moment in time where machine learning could suddenly classify stuff vastly better than anything else. And it was in a year, every other researcher that was doing non flipped over. And it was the same when that NeRF paper and NVIDIA sped it up. It was like, okay, this is clearly not going to be slowly improving. This is going to be improving in quantum leaps and bounds. And at this rate, we're going to have just an incredibly useful tool in no time at all.
I love that sort of force multiplier effect that happens when industry and academia sort of narrow in on a certain architecture. I mean, the same thing's happening with the transformer and diffusion architecture, right, on the generative AI side of the house. But to bring things back to spatial, I mean, like, I would say Instant NGP, amazing moment. It could answer the question, like, even faster than reality capture, like, as a classical photogrammetry tool with, you know, like, basically, will it NeRF? You could answer that question very, very quickly. Certainly, Luma made that accessible on mobile. And then I think the next interesting wave all happened with 3D Gaussian splatting. And the two companies I'd highlight there really, really are obviously, like, I have to point out, you know, Polycam. Polycam was one of the earliest apps on iOS to basically bring photogrammetry to the phone in your pocket using Apple's Object Capture API. And what was interesting about Gaussian splatting is, like, it was far closer to a photogrammetry pipeline. And the way to render this stuff, right, is far closer to classical 3D rendering implementations that you have today. So suddenly all these people that were like, oh, I don't know about this neural radiance field thing. I don't want to throw, like, a black box neural network in the middle of my pipeline and, like, app experience and creation experience, were able to be like, wait, it's just like this explicit representation of 3D Gaussians, which is like this old school concept. And we can render it at what, like, 500 frames per second versus like one frame per second, huh? And so, like, that unlocked also, like, you know, Polycam bringing this to their existing app and audience base. And the same thing with Scaniverse by the Niantic folks, incidentally, where they took it to the even next level where it's like, forget, you know, paying the Jensen tax and like, you know, waiting for your Gaussian splat to, in quotes, train on a GPU. You could do the entire training on your freaking iPhone. So like before you're done uploading your scan to Luma, Scaniverse is done processing your splat on your freaking iPhone. And so that's like another step there.
Which, by the way, I think is a trend we're seeing across the board and will continue to see, which is as you get more power at a GPU level at the end of the spoke, there's less reason to send stuff into the cloud or to the hub. Like at the moment, I think so much stuff is, you know, it's on the cloud and we just assume that it's going to be uploaded. But when you have large amounts of data and you want interactivity and low latency and stuff, I think there's a whole class of stuff that be it the iPhone or the iPad or whatever, that nodal sort of device has got enough power now that you can see, you know, like, yes, the training for the big models is going to be obviously requiring the fast computation, but I'm seeing more stuff being distributed out to the actual nodes for real-time interactivity. But I kind of digress. So
can I actually say one thing on that? Because it's interesting. I think it'll be interesting. It's like, A, you're spot on. Like, yes, training runs are getting bigger and bigger, but we have more compute at the edge. And now we're starting to use it for latency reasons, for privacy reasons. One of the most interesting things I saw recently that came out is from Microsoft, this thing called AI Recall, where it's basically taking intermittent screenshots of your Windows machine and then basically enabling semantic search over it. So like they're positioning it as photographic memory. But the reason I'm excited is what I think they'll do with that. Like obviously they're saying, oh yeah, like the data, the screenshots never leave your device, but will any derived insights from your device processed at the edge with your compute be sent back home? And the Microsoft EULA certainly lets them do that. And I expect the end game with that is basically going to be able to create an AI system that can use your computer and applications for you. I think this is such a common pain point for creatives and knowledge workers where it's like we're using four or five different tools, right, and duct taping them together in some sort of pipeline. How cool will it be if we can just like sort of screen record our interactions and then have our computer basically like turn that into a freaking automation? I'm so excited about that.
Okay. So, Bill, I've got to say that this is one point where I kind of bump. Like, I am all in on a lot of this stuff.
Let's go.
Use an analogy. This is the analogy that I think. I don't know if you remember a while ago, Apple had an event with U2, and on stage, Cook and Bono went, we're not only going to give you the new U2 album, but we're going to load it all the way onto your device. Yes. If you look at your device now, the new U2 album's there. And there was a big pushback on that. And Bono himself summed it up as, we're all keen for someone to give us free bottles of milk as long as they leave them at the front door. But it's creepy if they come into your house in the middle of the night and put it in your fridge while you're asleep. And I feel like this is that if you say to me, yes, I can have the computer monitoring what I'm doing in a session that I explicitly turn on, then that's leaving the milk at the front door. But if it's constantly doing everything that I'm doing, that's just surveillance. And I just think like there's a lot of things that I don't want surveilled. And I'm not talking about me looking at porn or anything like that. I mean, bank accounts, passwords, just private, you know, discussions that I feel like I want some space that's my space that's not being monitored. So I think that that is true, but only in a session-based thing that you would activate and that it would be totally explicit that it's happening. It's like recording the Zoom call, right? If I was recording you without you knowing, it's creepy. I'm recording you with your permission. It's really useful. But the 24/7 recording everything that you're doing, oh, I just think that's going to freak people out. It freaks me out and I'm not easily freaked out.
I think I would agree with those concerns, right? And it also, it needs to be opt-in ideally. Right now, it sounds like it's like an opt-out model. And I think that's the beef a lot of people have about generative AI training ethics too. It's like, oh, like, yeah, Shutterstock, you're training off of TurboSquid. Oh, is it opt-in or opt-down? Oh, it's like you have to opt out. How many people actually opt out? It's like 1 or 2%. Like, is it really ethical at that point? Because most people won't even notice that this thing is on. That said, I will say there's like overt surveillance and covert surveillance. And I think covertly, a lot of these things have been happening. I mean, in the Helen Toner interview that you alluded to, we talked about, you know, video surveillance. Like, and I mean, it ties into the visual spatial intelligence point that we're bringing up, where like, you know, like right now you could be sitting in a cafe and that cafe camera could be creating a very detailed profile about like how frequently you come in, how long you stay at the table, how many like cups of coffee has a barista served. When you go into a grocery store, especially in the US where there are no federal privacy laws, like you go into a grocery store, the same sort of analytics and tracking we're used to on the internet, where it's like, maybe you were on some e-commerce website and you almost checked out, but you didn't, and you abandoned your cart. Like basically grocery stores can do that type of analysis with video data and be like, wait, you walked up to this place and you put it in your cart, but you didn't.
Yeah. But I'm just going to point to Google, and I'm a big fan of Google, but like people were not happy when it discovered that incognito windows were not as incognito as we thought, right? Like, I think you want to have, it's not, I understand that people don't pay for privacy. Like we think that they should ask for a lot more privacy than they are willing to ask for. But basically people, when push comes to shove, won't pay for privacy. Nevertheless, I still feel like you feel like there should be some zones that are my zones. There should be, if I go incognito for whatever reason, it should be incognito. If I go and you know, doing stuff on my computer, it shouldn't automatically be logged. And it's not just a mistrust of corporations. It's just a history of discovering that things aren't quite as what they seem,
totally,
or that stuff's being sent back. So anyway, I'm not going to get conspiracy theory on us, but I just feel like that's going to be a difficult line to walk. And it may be that line where, as I say, you want stuff left at the front door, not coming in the middle of the night to your system.
It's a slippery slope. Okay,
I want to keep moving, because the other thing that you talked about next in your talk at FMX, which was great, was visual intelligence. Do you want to explain what that is?
Yeah. So visual intelligence, the academic definition, is basically to identify, understand, and act on imagery and visual data, just like a human vision system. And to me, this is like both visual and spatial intelligence. You can kind of lump them together as a class of really interesting work that might have been put under computer vision, quote unquote, is basically teaching machines to perceive the world and understand the contents in it. And once you can understand the contents in the world, understand the entities within it, understand cause and effect relationships, then you can take action in the world too. But they're very simple forms of visual intelligence, right? We talked about depth estimation, panoptic or full dense pixel segmentation being another form of that. Full body pose estimation would go into this category. Taking a mesh and classifying the triangles to be of different types of classes all falls into this bucket of technologies. And there's some really interesting applications.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ones that I love is the guys at Move AI. I think their ability to do motion capture from either, obviously they can do it from a single camera, but also you can do it from like a cluster of phones and get incredible multi-people, multi-viewed solutions of, it's not really photogrammetry, but it cross-references itself to get you pretty darn good motion capture,
totally,
especially compared to other options and at a fraction of the price. But what are other companies in this space that you've sort of seen or thought looked good?
I mean, certainly Move AI is one of them for the reasons you stated, right? And if you want to level up to the next, you know, kind of step from a bunch of iPhones, you can get a bunch of FLIR machine vision cameras with like pixel or line level sync and take it to the next level. One NVIDIA GPU, and you're doing like multi-party mocap in real time. I mean, I think that's absolutely wild. Certainly Wonder Dynamics is very interesting in this space, recently acquired by Autodesk, which is, you know, I saw your coverage on that, certainly have some thoughts on that too. But I think they really like kind of brought monocular pose estimation to the context of like cinematic visuals, because most of these pose estimation models, what I mean by that is most of these pose estimation models were really trained on, you know, cell phone data, because that's where these models were being deployed. It's like your Snapchat selfie filter, whatever, to center you in the position of a Zoom call, and not really looking at a range of like, you know, cinematic video captured with various focal lengths. And I think Wonder Dynamics made that super accessible and is also very, very interesting on the pose estimation front.
Yeah, just to unpack that a bit. By the way, I'm glad you've mentioned Snapchat, because actually I think the Snapchat engineers really don't get much love, because we kind of dismiss them as being toy-like or just frivolous. And yet those guys in their filters have come up with some remarkable stuff. It's like way beyond just kind of, you know, blur and stick on
totally
dodgy tracked ears. And yeah, it's quite remarkable actually what they've done. But now, leaving them aside for a second and getting back to Wonder Dynamics, I think the thing about that that I like is it isn't, it's a classic case of it isn't one AI. It isn't like the AI. It's in fact a lot of machine learning models, a lot of generative AI stuff to do infill, to do tracking, to do pose estimation, to do light estimation. Like there's a whole lot of things. And I think for me, that's really indicative of where things are going. And also the fact that they built that so that it isn't like a one-trick pony, but in fact, you can export out that clean plate, that motion data, that model, that solution, so that for somebody getting into visual effects, I feel like you or I, when we were younger, if we'd had that, it would have been such a rewarding thing because you could do something almost straight away and get a feel-good moment that I've done something. And then you've got the tools to take it further and refine it. And I feel like in a learning exercise, if you don't get some immediate feedback, some immediate kind of buzz that you've got somewhere, it's just too discouraging and you give up. So if you just started with Maya and went, I'm going to make this robot walk down my street from zero, you're going to be like ages before you can show your mate or your mum that you've done anything.
Totally.
Right? If you're using something like Wonder Studios, you can get something pretty quickly. And they're not the only one, but they certainly were very good at that kind of model.
Can I push back on that?
But I'm going to have to.
You've asked me to push back on you a little bit here.
Yeah, yeah. Please.
You know,
go
it's
right
funny.
Ahead.
I totally agree with this idea of like, to me, this is how AI in quotes should work, where it's like A, a federation of models, B, it's eliminating kind of the drudgery associated with these tasks, like where you're just be like, you know, kind of a computer monkey clicking on a bunch of buttons to get the thing to kind of work. And then you can start being artistic. But I've heard the counter argument a bunch too, where people have made the analogy of like, but Pallavel, this is like playing guitar. If you didn't build your calluses, you know, learning how to hold down every single note, you know, and coordinate your fretting and strumming hand, like, are you missing out on something? So do you think like by virtue of people sort of like the next generation of creators creating at this higher level of abstraction and almost losing touch with what it used to be like, is it just like the older generations like us basically being like, I don't know, a little pedantic about it? Or is there something there that's going to be lost?
I think it's absolutely the case that you need to like have experience to be good at something. And so you can't cheat experience by just having a runaround. But I also feel like an enormous number of people get discouraged because it's so hard to get anything that looks good. And the generation that we're talking about is kind of used to fairly fast feedback. They live in a world of TikTok and second screening and stuff. And I feel like if you can't get something happening, then it's too discouraging. But here's the thing, as great as Wonder Studios are, you can't really get it to do much beyond what it's sort of designed to do unless you export the elements out and then take it further, right? So it's a gateway drug, I feel, to playing with the tools, because once you've seen what you can do and you can get something happening, then you want to basically take that file into Blender or take that file into something like Maya. So I do feel that there's a huge advantage in doing those things. I don't think it excludes you from wanting to learn. And this comes to like a bigger discussion that I sort of had with some friends, which is around implicit and explicit. Mm. And I feel like the whole thing about Gen AI that we need to kind of get our heads around is that if you want it to implicitly do something, you give it a text string, which is really it implying an enormous amount from very little.
Yep.
And so that's great. But the inference that it's drawing is based on great statistical models, but it's not very directable because it's really a huge leap from a line of text to puppies in snow. Now, if you're happy with what you get from the puppies in snow, it's spectacular. But if you want to actually control which puppy is doing what, and because it needs to be the same puppy as in a shot you did yesterday and a whole lot of other stuff, then you need to start being explicit. And when you move to being explicit, then so much of these tools move from being a line of text that wondrously produces everything to being a bunch of small tools that I'm going to use in a much bigger pipeline. Because to be explicit is like, it's more than like 100x kind of complexity over the implicit. You'll get something with implicit that may look spectacular, but it's much out of your hands. The second you want it in your hands and you want to really craft exactly what's going on, you have to be explicit, and here you're not going to get explicit from a text prompt.
It's the chaotic golden. I 100% agree. I mean, it's the chaotic golden retriever, right? You're sitting, I call it slot machine AI. You're sitting there re-rolling these prompts over and over again, hoping to get something close to the vision in your head. And these tools lack that ability to give you that explicit control. I think companies like Runway ML are doing a great job of exploring sort of how do you blur the lines between explicit and implicit? Like, how do you give more finer grain sort of guidance using something like a motion brush, almost like artificially segmenting the scene and, you know, defining different movement characteristics for the different selections that you made to give you that middle way points. But it's not quite there yet, right? I think I was very excited about ControlNet when it first came out. And, you know, the idea of using sort of these like, you know, discriminative narrow models, AI models, of which there are many, pose, depth, edge detection, all that stuff, to sort of like tame the chaos of these diffusion models and make it more explicit, I think was very, very interesting. And I suspect that's a direction we'll see fleshed out in academia. But to bring it back and kind of like build off the, Wonder Dynamics example, you know, Wonder Dynamics is all about this problem in visual effects where it's like, I want to replace a physical character with this digital double, that, you know, whether it's fantastical or realistic. There's the inverse of that problem too, which is I've got real talent and I want to put them in a virtual environment. And one company that I think is doing a great job of that, making it accessible to that next generation too, right? Like without it being super onerous, like following some crazy, well, you know, it's funny. I was going to say video copilot tutorials, like shout out Andrew Kramer. I love the video copilot tutorials, but I think the next gen, it's too in the weeds for them. And so the company I'm talking about is called Skyglass VFX. And so basically it's a bunch of ex-Apple engineers, to your Snapchat point, that were building this like these perception and authoring capabilities in Apple that have basically made this app that's like, you can capture somebody, you can segment them in real time, you can see a preview of them in a pixel-streamed Unreal Engine virtual environment. So it's basically like the Unreal Engine virtual production pipeline on the phone in your pocket, and then you hit a button and it'll go up to the cloud to do a high-quality render, and it'll use another like, you know, visual intelligence capability to basically infer, like basically delight you and relight you then. So you can basically do real-time virtual production, virtual environments with relighting using the phone in your pocket. And you get something right out of the gate that you could upload to TikTok, YouTube Shorts, or whatever. But if you want that fine-grained control, you can export out a couple different passes, bring that into your compositing tool of choice, and do some amazing things. And so it's like really wild to me that even Unreal Engine virtual production became so much more democratized and accessible to people who, let's say, had a smaller budget of tens of thousands, and all you need is a freaking iPhone and a subscription. Like, that's kind of wild.
Yeah, yeah. I have it, obviously, and I've done exactly the same thing. But to testament to Skyglass's model being like that of Motion Dynamics, is the thing is that what I did was use their free one, instantly got rid of that and uploaded our own UE5 model, which is like a, you know, virtual environment.
Cool.
In fact, it's the virtual environment that is behind me right now.
Nice.
My only two things I'd say about that, right, is one is it's great, but it's kind of annoying that every time you switch it off and switch it on, you have to reload the model because it's in the cloud. So I kind of want to have a local model so that it would just, you know, not have to be constantly, because it's streaming what I'm looking like, it's streaming that me in the environment, and as it moves, it's updating the background live. I get why it's doing it, and I, with low latency, even with the running here from Sydney, it's brilliant. I totally love it. But yeah, it's definitely the same thing, right? It's the gateway drug, because you go, well, now I want my own model, and now I want my own environment. Now I want to get into UE5 and like build my own stuff so that I can take it in there. So I think that that's cool. Bill, I've just got to ask you one thing. Sure. You mentioned before you wanted to say something about Autodesk's acquisition, and I never got to hear what that was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's fascinating to me that this acquisition has happened. It's like my two cents on it are basically that, like, I feel like Autodesk almost has to acquire companies to make it monetarily worthwhile for them to build for the Autodesk ecosystem. And the reason I say that is like Blender is open source. They get all the fun, new, like cool AI tools, right? Like everyone's building the new Stable Diffusion plugin, the Simulon plugin. They're going to build it for Blender because it's free and accessible. Yet Maya is so important in higher end productions. And as obviously it's like it's like Oracle databases. If you go looking behind everything, it's still there, right? And so it's interesting to me that this acquisition happened, and I'm very curious to see if, as the founder said on your interview that you did, if Autodesk will continue to support Blender, because it's interesting to me that it's the only real competition, at least I see personally, to Maya that's out there. And if like Autodesk doesn't view it as competition and instead views Wonder Dynamics as sort of like, you know, an avenue for them to launch their own ML and perception capabilities into this other ecosystem, I think that would be very exciting. On the other hand, if they decide not to do that, or for whatever reason, I mean, stranger things have happened after acquisitions, not to discontinue Blender support, I think somebody like Simulon, who we've talked about, would get a huge boost because they would be the alternative for the Blender ecosystem. Right now, it's about objects. And I think Simulon is a step away from throwing in sort of that like pose estimation capability and in painting capability and creating something that's substantially similar to Wonder Studio is today.
Yeah, Simulon is really interesting, and its ability to, again, give you that sort of good version, and then it comes down from the cloud with the great version.
Yeah.
And the lighting stuff that they're doing in that is really great. But again, for me, I love that. But I also know the second that I do that, I start to, oh, hang on, there's an occlusion problem here. I'm going to need to take that and do some mats and do some other things. So it's not, and also they're, at the moment, those tools are, as great as they are confined to what you can sort of set up and do. So you've got the robot in your house, but if I want to have him walk outside and leap a tall building and jump up into a spaceship, like, it's very hard to do that without getting back to explicit, because I can't film somebody jumping up to a spaceship, and I can't film somebody jumping like that in any way to sort of copy their motion. I can just use it as reference. And so,
imagine,
I feel like we'll have more in that space. So go on,
I was going to say, imagine a future where, you're basically like, what I imagine happening with something like Simulon, by the way, they do that like thing you wanted Skyglass to do, which is give you that proxy geometry locally, right? So you're not necessarily, which is cool. And then they do the conform in the cloud. I'm excited about a future where like you've got that like, you know, view of the scene, right? You've laid out your characters and you're basically talking to these multimodal large language models, kind of like the stuff, you know, OpenAI showed with GPT-4o and Google showed with Project Astra. We're like, hey, I want the character to jump from here, drop annotation, till here, drop annotation. And hopefully, like, I'm really hoping that we'll see more in the text to mocap space, honestly. I think the big blocker there really has been a lack of training data. There's an interesting company called Heat.tech that's trying to be sort of the Getty Images of mocap, which I think is very interesting. Like basically creating an incentive structure for studios that have this mocap data to license it out. And then eventually the end goal would be, you know, kind of like, you know, I think the trajectory that Sketchfab and Epic Games is on with being able to train text to 3D models, or TurboSquid is on with text to 3D to be able to do this mocap thing, but then also then iterate with it so that at the end of the day, you do get something that's like a combination of implicit and explicit. That's the future I'm excited for. And that like suddenly when I see all those pieces coming together, right? Like you can do virtual characters, you can do virtual environments, relighting's great, you know, segmentation's great. You can start directing the talent very easily. You can infuse it with motion and do all of these cool things. It's like, holy crap, like how soon until like a kid in a basement has the same capabilities that James Cameron would have just like drooled over in 2009. And I don't think we're too far off from that.
So if you'd been the investor in Wonder Dynamics, would you have sold Wonder Dynamics to Autodesk?
I think that would probably have been the right move. They were between the, in terms of how they're positioned, given their like their pricing model, they're between the chasm of what is accessible for, let's say, like a YouTube creator, right? Like you very eloquently pointed out, like, hey, if you're using something like Simulon, you want all these other forms of fine grained control. A lot of YouTubers who are putting out regular content or TikTokers don't care about that, but that's not the audience that like Wonder Dynamics was going after. It was really after like, we want to give you like the best of both worlds. And so it's like too expensive for like a high-end YouTube TikTok creator, but still like without a laundry list of the feature sets that like any Disney studio would want. And so you fall into this precarious middle ground that I think is kind of tough. And so I think the best way to be able to subsidize that sort of development in that market maybe is through bundling and other approaches. And Autodesk in that context makes a lot of sense, right?
I have concerns about YouTube and or TikTok, and it's not a concern about them at the company level. My concern is this, that it's become increasingly apparent to me that people are using a lot of AI tools to make those videos. In particular, they're using text to voice rather than recording their own audio. And what I'm finding is that it's getting harder to find the good stuff because there's too much other stuff dropped in there, and there's too much clickbait. There's too much stuff that looks like it's going to be really good because they've got some graphics package that they've kind of bought that makes it look like it's high production value. But actually, when you open the video, it's very much just,
regurgitated
factory level. Yeah, exactly. And so I have the same, when I said to you earlier about the golden age of Google, it's not that I have any particular, you know, sort of hatred or lack of love for Google, but it's just, there's been this question in my mind that you had a platform that started out where it was trying to serve you the best result for what you wanted to look for on the net. And at some point, those platforms, Facebook included, moved to, we want to serve you the thing that's the most profitable to serve you because we're making a lot of money out of the monetization of your search. And I feel like that we're going to get a lot of people, companies contributing sort of fluff to the YouTube kind of things. And YouTube has been extraordinarily good up until, well, I mean, it still is today, of just saying, I've got a problem. Somebody on YouTube should be posted a video explaining how to do that, right? And the authenticity of those and the validity of those have made it just absolutely, you know, one of the places that I visit the most on the net. I think it's the second most visited site on the net, right? But once we start getting a lot of this stuff coming in, I'm just feeling like what I'm now going to need is the AI assistant to find me the good stuff, because I don't know that in both cases, both in YouTube and just generally on the net, that we're not going to have a cluttering problem, and that there's not just a, and look, I already have that problem with my television. I have every goddamn streaming service at home. And so I go, I want to watch this new episode of, and look, it's worse. I got to tell you, this is worse for me because I've got, anyway, I won't tell you what I've got, but the reality is I sit there sometimes going, now, where did I watch Clarkson's Farm?
Oh,
what
gosh.
Was that on? And like, unless I can remember, I'm like, is it this one? No, is it this one? Is it this one? And so, yeah, finding stuff, that's the downside of this. Like, once you say that the good enough is being served by generative AI, and I think that's the case,
The
floodgates open.
I mean, it's like there are a couple thoughts to that, right? Like, one is, definitely there is an explosion of content that's happening, right? And so as a consequence of that, you're basically going to have the multiverse of madness, right? Like, it's everything everywhere all at once. And that has happened every time we democratize certain capabilities, right? Like, oh, anyone, Web 2.0, anyone can write a blog. Bunch of blogs come online. Oh, anyone can upload images. Anyone can upload videos. And then parallel to that, as distribution got easier, creation has gotten easier and easier. And one might argue it is the easiest it has ever been today, right? Like, I had a Hi8 camcorder and would digitize video over S-Video TV tuner cards. And a kid has a friggin' 4K 60 FPS, you know, camera in their friggin' pocket and pixel streaming Unreal Engine coming down to it. So I think that's going to happen. I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think, like, there is this rise of disposable content, as I like to say, like, even with the shift from like YouTube long form videos, which the younger generation considers as long form. It's hilarious to me. It's like, really, a 10 minute video is long form now? But okay, everyone loves these shorts, but most shorts will be seen for a couple of days and that's it. There is zero shelf life. It's not evergreen content. On YouTube, I think you can still find that, right? On Netflix, shows can become popular years after they come out. And now with AI localization, you're taking shows from like this corpus of content that's just sitting there that's really good, that's now going to be accessible to everyone else. So there'll be examples of like this good stuff. Is there going to be a bunch of crap in the process too? Absolutely. I think the companies are well positioned to solve that problem. But you also bring up this third and final point about economic incentives. And I think that's challenging, right? Like, on one hand, Mike, I really want that AI assistant that can go out to all those platforms and find the best stuff for me and give me my feed for the day rather than me having, you know, almost subjecting myself to be hijacked by a supercomputer that's like optimized a list of things on Twitter or X or whatever for me to just like get my session length 1.5 minute longer or whatever. That's what's happening today, right? So we get hijacked every time we do this. I think having that intermediary is going to be very exciting, but it comes with the same downsides that we almost started talking about. It's like suddenly the window through which you see the world is no longer Google, which maybe was being personalized, but it's your assistant. And so whoever controls that assistant layer that mediates your, you know, interactions in the physical and digital world will wield a lot of power. And maybe we'll see an Apple-like, you know, people pay for privacy model where it's going to be super lightweight. It's there when you need it. It's not there when you don't. And it's going to be amazing. I'm not feeling overwhelmed by content all the time. Already, I notice Apple TV does that aggregation a little bit for me for various apps. I don't know if you use that, but if you don't, I deal with the same unbundling. There's another trend here of unbundling and rebundling, which clearly cable, you know, has totally been unbundled into a plurality of streaming services. But I think that economic incentive, you know, will drive the alternative to that sort of very nice her-like future, which will be sort of the dystopian videos where we've seen where people will buy the cheaper device, will buy the cheaper service, and basically be inundated with ads. And where I personally get a lot really worried, and I'm researching this for a future TED AI episode, is where all the neural stuff is coming up. You're wearing a pair of AirPods right now. Apple and Meta both have patents about being able to like coarsely sense your brain activity using air, you know, like non-invasive earbuds. And so just imagine we'll have more modalities for these systems to be able to, you know, glean inside us, like let alone your desktop, like what's going on in your noggin, dude. Like, so I think we'll see both a good and bad future. And as always, it'll be both things simultaneously.
Okay. So we're at that point, we have to discuss the two elephants in the room, right?
Yeah.
It's ChatGPT, especially 4.0 and Sora. So I think, let's start with Sora, right? I think it's really amazing. I think it's interesting what we've seen, and it's interesting that it's not generally released yet for the public. And the longer it goes not released to the public, the more the mythology around what it'll be able to pull off kind of grows. I think it's great, but as I said before, I don't think it's the one button that does everything for you, but it will facilitate the good enough crowd producing a huge amount of more stuff. But the explicit high quality crowd are going to maybe use it for ideation and experimentation, but it's not going to be, that's my take on Sora. What's your take?
I would certainly agree with that. What I would add to that is perhaps like, it's definitely not the one-click solution. I think it could automate my TikTok and YouTube Shorts channel. Like I'm making less than 1 minute long, you know, just short form videos with VFX and taking like a week to make some of them. Now I can do it in a day. I already tried making one in a day that I gave the example at FMX, a video that, by the way, any visual effects artist would look at and be like, this is utter dog crap. But somehow it got like 37 million views. So there you have it. I think it's going to be really game changing for short form video creation. That the what's still elusive with Sora, the image models, really any kind of diffusion based approach, even if you add the time component, which all these systems are doing, like sort of the space time thing. I even had a chance to see Project Veo and get hands on with it. Google I/O, that's Google's Sora competitor, which is also really good. But all of them have this issue of like, it doesn't understand the entities that I'm actually talking about. And it doesn't know how to make those entities consistent across generations, whether that's the character, the prop, the environment, the lighting conditions. And so I think like that needs to be solved. And I don't think that's just like, you know, more synthetic training data problem. Maybe that's like the ultimate brute force approach way to do it is just like crank out enough Unreal Engine synthetic data of all permutations and combinations so you can get some level of consistency and control. But I think,
for people listening, like a good example of that for me is I did a yacht sailing in Sydney Harbour, and the camera was meant to fly around 360 around the yacht. And because it was 360 around a yacht in Sydney Harbour, to us, that's pretty obvious what's going to happen, right? To the generative AI, as it went around the yacht, it kept on finding the Sydney Opera House and the Sydney Harbour Bridge multiple times, right? Because Sydney Harbour is defined by those two landmarks. And so if you want to know you're in Sydney Harbour during the entire duration of that 360 spin around the yacht, you need to keep seeing the Opera House and the Sydney Harbour Bridge, even though there aren't, in fact, six of those in Sydney. There's just one of each, right?
Totally.
And it's that classic thing where you go, well, I thought I was explicit that it was in Sydney Harbour. Why are you sticking me six opera houses? And it's saying, but you wanted it to be in Sydney Harbour. And I know what makes a shot look like Sydney Harbour. It's that opera house.
Totally.
Some of that's, and as I say, I don't think that's a training data problem so much as it is just,
architectural
and a spatial problem.
Oh,
right?
Totally.
Like it's just needing to have some
dimensionality.
So dimensionality, yeah, it's probably solvable.
And this is also where I think the answer isn't just one model, right? Like, I think what I'm still bullish on is some sort of hybrid approach where like you've got like a explicit 3D scene graph where you can exert fine grained control. And then you sort of use, I had a chance to ask Jensen Huang about this, like at GTC. It's like, and then you can use these diffusion models or whatever to kind of take it all the way. So if you want to have like, I want to move just this cloud around just oh so slightly or make those type of changes, you can do them. And so I'm interested to see if we'll see models that can kind of, even if it's not literally duct taping two models together, some sort of new architecture that does expose
the 3D
scene graph.
I couldn't agree more. Don't you think it's going to be, it's like multimodal on steroids.
Oh, 100%.
I want to be able to give it the Google map reference of Sydney Harbour and say, okay, so you know how harbours look and here's some spatial information. And by the way, here's a photo of the yacht so that you can, you know, get the right thing. Okay. And so
breathe life into it. That take that static 3D scan and breathe life into it and then layer in whatever else you
and
want.
Understand what a map is.
Yeah.
And that it's a representation of spatial geometry. Okay. So ChatGPT 4.0, some people would say it's just ChatGPT with a how can I put a sexier, flirtier voice.
Me? The announcement is about me? Well, color me intrigued. Are you about to reveal something about AI, or more specifically about me as a part of OpenAI? You've got me on the edge of my, well, I don't really have a seat, but you get the idea. What's the big news?
Yeah, we've got a new model that can interact with the world through audio, vision, and text.
Okay, ChatGPT with a flirtier voice. I mean, do we want to talk about the Scarlett Johansson thing? Is that something you've gotten into yet? Likeness and
I haven't
all
got into it. I've obviously investigated. I guess my thing is, it's the height of hubris to ignore the requests of an artist. And, but then by the flip side of that is if you hired a sound alike, then the kind of, that's what people do, right? They hire impersonators all the time. But yeah, clearly to me that crossed the line into, you know, they clearly wanted something, they couldn't get it. So they just went for it anyway. That's my personal opinion.
Well, what's damning to me there is like the fact that like Scarlett Johansson was called 2 days before the launch. It's like, okay, like who thinks that you're going to get a deal for a Hollywood celebrity's likeness 2 days before? Like,
well, that was the second time they called her, right?
Exactly.
They called her initially and she said no. And then they said, you sure?
Yeah. So by the way, we don't know the identity of the person who voiced Sky. I would think that if I was that voice actor, I would love for my name to be out there. It'd be a lot more interesting business and inbound.
And let's face it, it didn't help matters when the CEO posted the word her.
This is like, people often joked, like, you know, so in tech, everyone's like, oh, Silicon Valley, the TV show. I don't watch it because it's too close to home. And it's like, this just feels like an episode of Silicon Valley to me.
So, by the way, I adore that show. Like, I swear to God, I laughed up every single episode. I thought it was brilliant. You must have loved it as
I
well.
I loved it. And if you want to get some real laughs, go watch their, like, Toxic Google. The whole, like, cast goes to Toxic Google. And they just, like, roast the crap out of the entire room. It's beautiful. But back to GPT 4.0. What I'm excited about is multimodality. I think we were nerding about multimodality here. It's like the fact that I think text is just such a fickle way to describe what you have in mind. Yes, it's a great abstraction, but I think a lot of people are visual. And so the fact that these systems can now understand, you know, reason about, and I say reason in air quotes here, is like reason about text, image, visual, Text, image, video, and audio together, I think is going to be very, very powerful for that Jarvis-like assistant that we all want, right? Now, whether you want to instantiate an angry coach that's going to shout at you and get you to go to your gym workout, or if you want that, like, almost a, like, her, like, girlfriend, I think you're going to see both of those futures and everything, every, you know, color of the rainbow, you know, across the gamut in between. But what's exciting to me, again, is just, like, the fact that these machines can now understand context way better. I would argue that, like, you know, Gemini illustrated and showcased that better. They got a bunch of crap for their demo. And now, obviously, we got two premier labs that are building very similar capabilities with GPT-4o and Project Astra. And I think, like,
I mean, yeah, competition is healthy in this case.
Oh, hell yeah. And I think it's also going to be one of those killer AR use cases. Like, the only, in quotes, AR device that I really, really use is the Meta glasses. And I don't like using Llama on it, but it does have that amazing camera. And I largely use them as AirPods replacements when I'm taking, like, calls, walking around, things like that. And I think the fact that I'm going to be able to infuse intelligence into this, all the stuff that, like, you know, that AI Pan, the Rabbit, all these companies are talking about, I think that capability is just going to be commodity and everyone's going to be able to build on it. Question is, what will we build on it? I got a feeling that's where things are going to get very, very exciting. Even going back to the ability for these machines to reason about what the hell are you doing on your desktop? Like, oh yeah, you're like getting your images ready for reality capture here and like applying a LUT to them. Oh, now you're tossing them into this like posing pipeline. Now you're throwing them into this nerfing or splatting pipeline. And then it being able to help you automate all of that, I think it's going to be so powerful.
Yeah. So I want a question for you, like looking forward. Yeah. About traditional rendering. So this isn't widely discussed, but I thought I'd get your take on it, right? At the moment, we've got an entire beautiful history of decades of work in refining progressively better and better quality photo realistic renderers, right? That can ray trace and do volumetrics and do all this kind of stuff. And we end up with these magnificent films that Pixar and others do that are just beautiful. The question is, do you see, there's obviously machine learning in that, especially in noise reduction, yep, and that facilitates that being done. But do you see like a move to getting neural renderers happening as a sort of phenomenon, like having some kind of basically less ray traced, not scan line, but actually an inferred solution based off a 3D model? So taking your 3D, still having a sense of it, because in one sense, we have in a NeRF the model in the neural network, right? That's, yep, what a NeRF is, right? The model exists in it. And that latent space is incredibly great in terms of compression. And of course, it produces photorealistic stuff out of that. Mm-hmm. And so not that we see this as a product right now, but like, I'm just wondering, do you see like they're continuing to be a path for high-end 3D renderers like Arnold and RenderMan, or and a completely separate path for inferred rendering, or are they going to merge beyond, say, noise reduction?
I mean, noise reduction is such a great example. I think it'll be a gradual transition, right? And maybe a poetic one, because the training data for these, like, you know, neural implicit approaches will be from these classical, you know, 3D render engines, right? Like already we're seeing Unreal being so important for what Sora is doing. So I think synthetic training data is going to be one way these engines kind of live on. But I think that transition is inevitable, right? Like, it's like, I'm really excited about this future where, let's say you have that back to that lightweight scene graph in a freaking browser. And let's say you're running some like local neural network that just like does that final layer for you. To me, it's basically like NVIDIA's deep learning super sampling, DLSS on steroids, right? Right now, it's just like super sampling, upscaling it for you. But if you look at tools like Magnific AI, which is nothing but Stable Diffusion plus with like really nice LoRAs to get you to creatively upscale something, not just like factually try and upscale something. I think it's just like inevitable that that's going to be powerful, right? Because you'll still have that 3D control, but you'll be able to have photorealistic visuals rendered at a fraction, you know, of the time that it would take to do with some of these classical offline rendering solutions. So I think you'll see like a gradual transition. That said,
so just to be clear about this, you're thinking, yeah, like I would have a metahuman out of Unreal that looks still
wonky.
It looks good, but it's still, well, uncanny. Let's call it a bit more gamey. Yeah. And then you would just say, okay, make that look real.
Totally.
Make that look like like you've got a proxy for Mike Seymour. You know what Mike Seymour looks like.
Totally.
Give me, and that would, and then you would on top of that, what? I want a bokeh with kind of cinematic kind of backlighting, and you'd sort of overlay these things on top. Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly right. And I think the layer to which you rely on that, like, you know, ML piece at the end is just going to expand. Like right now it's just upscaling, right? And let's say it's creative upscaling. Then it's like the example you gave of like uncanniness to, oh wow, like the light transport effects look like photorealistic, to like the underlying representations can get simpler and simpler, right? And so basically eventually we'll be in a place where these games are basically like dreams in, you know, in the cloud that you can navigate, and then eventually like something that runs on your freaking iPhone. I think that's inevitable. I will not bother trying to be a futurist and make a prediction about how long that's going to take. But I did ask, going back to Jensen, him to make a prediction, because he said in the future, every pixel will be generated, not rendered. And he thinks it's this innovation S curve that's going to take 10 years. And we're maybe inching towards like the first, like third of that. And so maybe in the next 5 to 8 years, everything would be possible to be fully generative. Whether it happens sooner or later, God knows. But I think the trend towards that direction is just so powerful, especially if you can retain that explicit underlying control. Like why? Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask you that question, right? Because you managed to get that quote out of Jensen, which you touched on at FMX. And I remember thinking, you said it not in passing, but you didn't make a big deal out of it. But I thought, wow, like right there, that is an incredibly significant comment to be made. I mean, there's a lot to that comment if you really think about it.
I think it's totally wild. I would also say like Jensen obviously is a bias because like, you know, like they're basically in any future of all of this, right? Like whether it's Octane Render or some like, you know, new thing, it's all running on GPUs. But I think like generative is the thing du jour. So I think it is very significant. It's also interesting that they're investing so much into Omniverse, right? Which is sort of like the synthetic training data generator for all of this, using, you know, classical approaches, shall we say, to like, you know, model the complexity and beauty of reality. So clearly they see that path to being able to have like own your own, in quotes, classical 3D rendering engine, but then use that to create these other models. And this trend repeats itself again and again. If you look at what's happening in climate too, it's funny, like climate science is applying diffusion models to upscale basically climate prediction. So like, oh, the storm is going to pass through Taiwan and like disrupt supply chains for a little while. They can up-res that to get far more micro scale predictions. And it's the same exact thing where like they're going back even for climate prediction, taking these old CPU based models, having them create a bunch of training data, and then training these new ML based approaches to be able to just like run the, like get that same type of analysis, but at a fraction of the cost, which then lets them apply it in more places. Instead of running this super compute intensive climate simulation for like some small part of Europe, you can do it for all of the world, right? And so I think the same thing will happen with 3D rendering engine. With a 3D rendering engine, it'll become a commodity and be used almost everywhere. And you'll just have different dials on how you want to crank it up or down. Yeah.
Yeah, you've inadvertently come across the last point I wanted to discuss with you, which is kind of the... one of the things that I find difficult to even discuss, which is the truth in generative AI. So in what you described then, you're extrapolating on a statistical model to give you more information based off your weather example, right? But that's doing incredibly important stuff that has real impact on people's lives. So let me just reframe this question and say, people treat a lot of generative AI, they treat ChatGPT as if it was a Google search on what is a fact. But a large language model is not a keeper of facts. It doesn't store information in the way that we would think of as some kind of even computer readable factual basis. It does a stylistic understanding of something. I use the banana example. The banana example is it doesn't store pictures of bananas. It understands what is bananiness.
Yep.
And bananiness is yellow and bent and kind of, it has the properties of bananiness, but not a whole catalog of every banana shot it's ever seen. It's learned from every shot it's ever seen, but not keeping every shot that it's ever seen, which means that if you ask it to give you a fact, it's not looking up a database of facts. It's giving you the most plausible response. And again, my own example is I used to ask it about me and it used to give an incredibly accurate, detailed response of what I did, except for it named the wrong university that I was associated with. And the reason for that is that it was saying most of the people that do the work that a Mike Seymour-ness guy does is most probably done at this other university. Now, obviously, that university isn't as good as my university, so I'm not there. But this one anomaly in that it's statistically most probable that I'd be doing this research at another uni causes it to say that's where I am, or that's where I, you know, got my PhD and stuff. And it's not a fact machine, so it just gets that fact blatantly wrong. When any number of factual things on the internet would say my association was with Sydney University, not this other university. So here's my problem, right? In your weather case, it sounds all great and good, except for generative AI doesn't give us the facts about weather. It's going to statistically interpret a probable outcome, but it does this so effectively that everybody tends to think of it as being an oracle of knowledge, not a inferred style statistical prediction of knowledge, if that makes sense.
It's a beautiful point. You're hitting on this tension. There are two tensions here. One is, can these models just remix existing knowledge, or can they create net new knowledge? That's one thing like that a lot of people are debating. I think the other one is basically that, like, can these machines actually reason about stuff? And right now the answer is these systems, these large language models, these diffusion models, they can't reason, right? Like, they don't know who Mike Seymour is, and that Mike Seymour is a human, like that Mike Seymour has five fingers on each hand, like all this, it doesn't know that, right? Like, and so the way I think about all these systems as, like, again, is that, like, chaotic golden retriever. It's like, it is not the librarian. Really, like, an analogy that might be helpful for your listeners is to think of large language models basically as, like, really fancy but lossy lookup tables. Like, if you give it enough, if it's in the training data, and by the way, this is the hidden part of generative AI and these large language models that people aren't talking about. Even to write Python code, there's, like, armies of, like, humans sitting overseas that are taking a wrong output and fixing it for them to say, no, the Python code should be this, so that the most commonly asked for tasks then get better and better. Now, can it actually reason? That's a debated topic, and I'll leave that to the academics. But what I will say is, like, definitely don't treat these models as, like, their output as gospel. It seems like they are, but they definitely aren't. And I think there's going to be a huge space for, like, we're talking about an explicit scene graph on the information side, an explicit knowledge graph. What do you know? How do you know it? And can you point to the provenance of something? So I think some sort of marriage of, like a search knowledge graph, which, by the way, itself has debates over what's true or not, right? Like, married with sort of the creative, you know, abilities of generative AI systems, I think will be interesting. So all this to say, I don't think LLMs just throw more data and compute. I personally don't believe throw more data and compute all of them is all you need. There's a lot of people who do believe that. It almost starts sounding to me what Gary Marcus likes to call it's a bit like, God, what was the art and science of, like, making gold? Alchemy.
Alchemy.
It starts sounding like alchemy, right? And people don't know. It's like, well, we just bake the cake. You know, we don't know what's going to come out, but something good's going to come out. Oh, look, has these emergent properties. So I personally think, like, it's going to be, to your earlier point, a federation of approaches that solve that problem. And maybe it is an old school knowledge graph and these newer approaches. Maybe it is not just neural, but neurosymbolic. So certainly for systems where, like, life-changing decisions are made, like, imagine Helen Toner brought up this example, right? Like, of if somebody loses Medicare because some AI system decided that, and it did it based on next word prediction. I mean, like, that's one thing, right? Sure, you can stuff in whatever context. You could have a huge context window where you could throw in all the context about that applicant, all other related applicants, and get maybe a reasonable prediction. But can you actually ask it to reason why it came to that answer? Or will it just be predicting what the reasoning should be? So I think, like, there's a step from where the models are today, you know, which is just they're super creative at identifying the common structure across a lot of information. And the way that latent space is generated is very unintuitive to us. It certainly isn't canonical, but it's one way to represent and, in a sense, compress down all that data. So I think if you take a system like that and combine it with a symbolic approach, I think some magical stuff's going to happen. Or, hey, maybe I'll be wrong and just more data and compute is all you need.
Bill Bell, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about all this stuff. It's been great just having you on and going through those things. If somebody's interested to connect up with your stuff, we've already mentioned the TED AI podcast. Are there other places, they like a website that they can go to, or, you know, to
absolutely
connect with you or follow what you're doing?
Yeah, please. www.bilawal.com, BILAWAL.in. You can find me on Twitter. Would love to connect with you there. LinkedIn works too. And yeah, check out my Substack if that's something of interest. Spatialintelligence.ai.
Bilawal, it's been just brilliant talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much, Bilawal, for taking the time to chat with us. We'll, of course, be working hard here at FX Guide to keep you updated with things that are happening in the always changing machine learning and AI space. Well, that's it for this episode of the FX Podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.